Well, the debt debate battle is another test of leadership in Washington, and according to our next guest, the leaders involved should go into seclusion. Former Yale professor William Derezowitz gave that advice in a now famous address to the plebe or freshman class at West Point last fall. It's all the rage on social media. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. In a speech, Derezowitz cites the Vietnam-era film Apocalypse Now, in which the renegade Colonel Kurtz has set up a military outpost, and higher-ups tell Captain Woolard to go get him.
Your mission is to proceed up the Nung River in a Navy patrol boat. Pick up Colonel Kurtz's path at Nu Mung Ba. Follow it, learn what you can along the way. When you find the colonel, infiltrate his team by whatever means available, and terminate the colonel's command.
Terminate with extreme prejudice, they say. But Derezowitz reminds us that film is based on Conrad's century-old novel, Heart of Darkness, which is about a company man being asked to go on a mission. It's about bureaucracy, and he somehow draws a line from it to the effects of social media on today's young people. The title of his speech is Solitude and Leadership, and William Derezowitz, who's also an author, his new book is A Jane Austen Education, joins us from the studios of Oregon Public Radio. William, Bill, welcome.
Thanks very much.
Leadership and solitude, right there in the title. As you say, you know it's a contradiction.
Right. But my argument really has three very simple pieces. I say, what is leadership? And my answer is, ultimately, it means being able to think for yourself. And how do you think for yourself? You need to be alone. And that means turning off the social media. So solitude and leadership, although it seems contradictory, to me, they are essential parts of each other, right. Or at least solitude is an essential part of leadership.
Well, we want to get more to the solitude part, but the reaction to this, have you been surprised?
I've been amazed and gratified, of course. This piece is being read and taught across the military at places like the Army War College. And in business, I've heard from a lot of executives at major corporations, the Aspen Institute, I guess very high-level sort of gathering place for leaders of various kinds, they're doing some seminars this summer on global leadership, and they want to use the piece. I was an English professor. I, quite frankly, have never had any experience in leadership positions. My only experience with leadership is being the object of other people's attempts to exert it. You know, but it's obviously really struck a chord in people.
Well, sure, because you say the things that a lot of people want to say. You remind them that we're all in a bureaucracy. And why is it that the best people are usually stuck in the middle and the people running things, the leaders, are mediocre? And then you go on to say excellence isn't what gets you up a greasy pole. What gets you up is kissing up to people above you, kicking down the people below you, pleasing your teachers, your superiors, picking a powerful mentor, riding their coattails until it's time to stab them in the back, jumping through hoops.
But this is what made me make the connection with Heart of Darkness, with Conrad's great novel. Normally, we think of that novel, we think in terms of colonialism, in terms of racism, and that's all appropriate. But what I realized as I was teaching it for the second or third time is that it's also about bureaucracy. It's, after all, it's about a company. He goes out under the aegis of a company, company with a capital C, and the people he meets out there are functionaries of the company. And the main one is the manager of the central station. And as I was reading the description of this manager, it's this brilliant description, you know, as I was reading it for like the sixth or tenth time, I realized that's the chairman of my department. This is a person who's described as having a talent for keeping the system going, for making his subordinates feel vaguely uneasy. And other than that, he seems to have nothing inside him. I think he says, you know, you feel like you could poke your finger through him and there'd just be a little bit of dirt there.
Well, and so you tell this story to these plebes. As I was reading your speech and hearing you talk to them about, do you want to be that person that's just right. The one who gives off a whiff of something right. threatening, or do you want to be a real leader? And I started right. thinking, you know, when I think of real leader in the military, I think of the guy you talk about, General David Petraeus.
There was a time when he was a 2- or 3-star general when he was talking about how, as I understand it, he was talking about how the counterinsurgency wasn't going very well. And he didn't get a very good reception in the Pentagon, and his career was kind of sidetracked for a while, and he was put in charge of training the Iraqi army, which was not considered, it was sort of a career ender. And eventually, you know, his counterinsurgency doctrine was vindicated, and now he's lionized as the great leader.
We, in fact, spoke to General Petraeus when he was running Mosul in 2003, commander of the 101st Airborne, and then he was sort of sent into exile, pretty much.
Right.
And that's when he wrote the counterinsurgency manual and came back.
Right.
And now, of course, going to be replacing Leon Panetta in the CIA.
Right.
But what are these kids sitting in front of you, what are their faces doing when you're telling them, try to be the guy who got sent into exile first?
Right. Well, they were sitting there in their dress grays, very impressive. Their faces were pretty poker face during the talk, but I'm very gratified to be able to say that they actually gave me a standing ovation. Look, I think that what I found at West Point is what I have found when I've gone around to other elite schools, places like Stanford or Harvard, and have talked about similar issues for the last few years, which is that there's a tremendous hunger among young people today to be given permission to think for themselves, not just to jump through hoops, which is how I think we're training them, whether we do this intentionally or not, to behave.
Well, it's funny. You also speak in the essay and spoke to the plebes about being on the Yale admissions committee a few years ago. And you say the first thing the admissions officer would do would be to read what's called the brag. And this is the list of the students' extracurriculars. This was stunning.
Right. Well, what I found out is that if you had six extracurriculars, you already had a strike against you, because the kind of person who got in typically had more like 10 or 11.
How's that possible?
Well, I don't really think it is possible. I mean, I believe that they're all doing these things, but I don't think they're able to do any of them very well. And I certainly don't think that they're able to develop what we want them to develop, which is a sense of passion and purpose and vocation and mission. Because you can't do that if you have to spread yourself all over the map. If you have to be great at everything, do everything, be all things to all teachers, as David Brooks has said, you aren't going to be the kind of person who develops an inner compass. And that's what a leader really is. Not someone who's excellent at everything, or even someone who's excellent at one thing, but someone who has an inner compass, who has what I call moral imagination, which is the ability to think of new choices for yourself and for society as a whole, new ways to live as an individual in a society. And not just moral imagination, but moral courage. I mean, that, I think, is what was so impressive about David Petraeus, is that he was actually willing to act on his ideas, which is usually a death sentence in a bureaucracy. You need a lot of inner strength to have that moral courage to say, I'm not going to behave the way everyone wants me to behave. And I don't really think we're doing a good job developing that in young people.
I know you've had sort of a response of, you know, why did this resonate so much? And spoke to a friend in business school.
I asked her, why is this article resonating so much? What do people in business talk about when they talk about leadership? And she said, well, you know how you say that being a leader isn't about climbing the greasy pole? Well, in business school, that's what they teach you, is how to climb the greasy pole. And people really want to hear that maybe there's some alternative for themselves other than just doing that.
Essayist and former Yale professor William Derezowitz, who made a now famous speech at West Point telling the cadets leadership means thinking your own thoughts. Bill Derezowitz, let's pick up where we left off. You were also an admissions counselor at Yale. As you say, the kids that you were helping get into Yale sound like terrific kids, not just 10 or 11 extracurricular activities, but perfect grades and top scores. But as one of them said to you, excellent sheep. And by the way, we were reading recently reports of how kids being prepared for these top colleges are not only going to private prep schools for maybe $35,000 a year, but their parents are spending $35,000 a year on tutors.
Right.
You're saying the result of that is world-class hoop jumpers. And one of the things that has to change is this idea of solitude so that they can learn to think for themselves. What did you tell the plebes to do?
Well, I told them to turn off their cell phones, stop checking Facebook. And I should also say there's nothing wrong with being connected. There's a great deal of value in that too, just not all the time. You need to be able to just have a sense of inner peace. I mean, I think everyone knows what I'm talking about. I'm not trying to sound like Deepak Chopra here. It's just, I think we all know what that feels like when we manage to turn off the media and open a book, or maybe just sit and think, or write a long letter, or have a long conversation with someone we're very close to.
You give them your own example. You say for yourself, your first thought is never your best thought, and it's usually someone else's, and then you have to find your own. But also how we forget that real thinking comes slowly. You tell them about how some of the great books have been written.
James Joyce wrote Ulysses at the rate of about half a page a day for 7 years. T.S. Eliot, whom some people consider the greatest American poet, wrote about 200 pages of poetry in his life, not including some of the lighter stuff, about 200 pages, which is a few lines a month. I read somebody say recently that, you know, the novel is obsolete, War and Peace comes from an information-poor time. And I want to say, read War and Peace, read a couple of pages of War and Peace, and you'll see that you're not getting the same kind of information that you're getting from Twitter or from Facebook messages. It's not just the volume of information, it's the kind of information we're getting. And when we're thinking one sentence at a time or communicating one sentence at a time, we never go very deep with anything. And sometimes it takes 1,200 pages to say something really valuable, to get to the point that you're really trying to say. Or with a friend, sometimes it takes 10 pages, a 10-page letter, in order to discover the feelings that you're trying to articulate.
Or, as you say, sometimes a 3-hour conversation, face-to-face.
Right.
Instead of, 365 friends on Facebook, one friend face-to-face.
I tell them that, again, counterintuitively, one form of solitude, as far as I'm concerned, is friendship, or at least that kind of friendship that you were just talking about, where you have time to really have a conversation with someone who you can trust, tell your innermost thoughts to, and not just to tell them to, but, as I said before, to discover them in the presence of, in the course of this long, involved conversation. I mean, I think that's how some of my best ideas have come. And also some of my most important understandings of myself have come by talking with one other person.
Mm. Well, and tie this all in, this kind of, you know, solitude, quiet, introspection, trying to find your own thoughts instead of just being bombarded with other people's. Bring that back to leadership. You have a great Emerson quote. You write, Emerson said, "He who should inspire and lead his race must be defended from traveling with the souls of other men, from living, breathing, reading, and writing in the daily, time-worn yoke of their opinions."
And Emerson, who I don't think was a big fan of the formal education of his time, he said the one good thing about college, at least in his day, it's not really true anymore often, is that at least you get a room to yourself. Like, literally, you get your own room where you can shut the door and think your own thoughts. And he also said that, you know, this is where sort of the leaders of the race, as he would have called them, the leaders of the human race, come from. They come from people not traveling in the time-worn opinions of everyone else.
That's William Derezowitz, former Yale professor, whose talk with the plebe freshman class at West Point last fall has been reverberating. It's called Solitude and Leadership. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. It was also published in The American Scholar. His latest book is A Jane Austen Education. By the way, given your interest in Jane Austen, I want you to weigh in on the big dust-up between V.S. Naipaul and Jane Austen. Naipaul saying that her writing was so much feminine tosh and that she was sentimental and that women in general couldn't be the writers that men could be because we take the vapors or something. Your thoughts?
Yes, I think he specifically said that no woman could ever be as great a writer as he is. Look, I mean, Naipaul has been saying this kind of thing for a long time, about one thing or another. He's this grumpy old man. My take on him is that despite his Nobel Prize and his reputation, he's kind of bitter about the fact that his career never really went where he thought it was going to. I mean, he published a book, A House for Mr. Bishwas, when he was in his late 20s. That's an absolutely brilliant book. And I don't think that he ever quite fulfilled his potential. So he goes around saying these kinds of things. I mean, what he says about Jane Austen and women writers in general is the biggest cliche, the least original thing you can possibly imagine. People have been saying this ever since she wrote. Women write about trivial things. Women write about narrow things. They're sentimental. I mean, the fact is that Jane Austen is not only a great writer. She's a great writer because she was a woman. Because instead of going out hunting and shooting and conquering India like the men of her time, she was sitting in a drawing room watching how people interacted, listening to how they talked. She's the greatest writer of dialogue in the language after Shakespeare because she listened to how people talk. And the real irony here is that Naipaul himself could never have accomplished his greatest achievement, A House for Mr. Bishwas, if Jane Austen hadn't written, because it's a thoroughly Austenian book. It's like Austen in Trinidad. He implicitly associates what he's doing with Dickens. But the fact is, it's a book about people interacting, the subtleties and importance of everyday social interaction – within a family group in a highly structured social situation. It is exactly what he learned from Jane Austen, but will never admit to.
Take that, V.S. Naipaul.
Indeed.
Bill Derezowitz, thanks so much.
You're welcome.